wolf went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he drove. Hi-hey.
This is Samantha Dickens, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Western Stories. Today I am reading No Rest for the Wicked by Louis L'Amour. There's an author's note here at the beginning. It takes two kinds of men to develop a mining country, the men who find the mines and the men who develop them, and they are rarely the same person. The prospector, the discoverer, is not often equipped in money and the business ability to open up and develop a mine. Many of them sold their claim off for what seemed nothing, and yet it was to them a great deal, and if they had persisted in operating their mines, they might have lost everything. Some men only wanted what they could take out by themselves. They kept their discoveries a secret, going back again and again to take out what they needed, and when they died, of disease, accident, or gunplay, the mine's location was lost. From the ridge on my Colorado ranch, I can look across a bunch of mountains where there are dozens of lost mines. At least two of them are somewhere in the range of my vision. Find them? It isn't easy. It's a big, big country, and prospecting is a slow, painstaking operation. Since prospectors gave up the burro for the jeep, fewer mines are found. Jeeps can't go into the roughest country, and many of the best mines were found at places where no man in his right mind would want to go. So we begin our story, No Rest for the Wicked. The batwing doors slammed open as if struck by a charging steer, and he stood there, framed for an instant in the doorway, a huge man with a golden beard and magnificent shoulders, towering 5 inches over 6 feet, and weighing no less than 250 pounds, he appeared from out of the desert like some suddenly reincarnated primeval giant. He was dirty, not with the dirt of indigence, but with the dust and grime of travel. He smelled of the trail, and his cheekbones had a desert bronze upon them. As he strode to the bar, there was something reckless and arrogant about him that raised the hackles on the back of my neck. Stopping near me, he called for a bottle, and when he had it in his hand, he poured 3 fingers into a water glass and took it neat. He followed with its twin before he paused to look around. He glanced at the tables where men played cards and then at the roulette wheel. His eyes rested on the faces of the gamblers, and then at last they swung around to me. Oh, I knew he was coming to me. He had seen me when he came in, but he saved me for last. His look measured me and essayed me with a long, deliberately contemptuous glance, for I am a big man too, and the difference between us was slight. Yet where he was golden, I was black, and where the heat had reddened his cheekbones, I was deep browned by sun and wind. We measured each other like 2 stranger mastiffs, and neither of us liked the other. He looked from my eyes to the star on my chest and to the gun low slung on my leg. He grinned then, a slow, insulting grin. "The town clown," he said. "Exactly," I replied and smiled at him. For I could see it then, knew it was coming, and I could afford to wait. He measured me again when he saw that I did not anger. He changed suddenly, shrugging, and smiled. "No offense," he said, and his smile seemed genuine. "I've got a loose tongue." He reached in his pocket and drew out 3 pieces of ore and rolled them on the bar. "Besides, I feel too good to make trouble for anybody today. I have found the lost village diggings." His voice had not lifted a note, and yet had he shouted the words he could have received no more attention. Every head turned. Men came to their feet. All eyes were on him, all ears listening. "The lost village diggings!" Old Tom Curtis grabbed the stranger by the arm. "You found him? You actually have? Where?" The big man chuckled. "Did name to get you folks upset," he said. "Look for yourself." He nudged the oar with his fist. "How's that look?" Curtis grabbed up the oar. His eyes were hot with excitement. He was almost moaning in his reverence.
Why, it must run $3,000 or $4,000 to the ton. Look at it."
The chunks of ore were ribbed with gold, bright and lovely to see. But I spared the gold only a glance. My eyes were on the stranger, and I was waiting. They crowded around him, shouting their questions, eager to see and to handle the ore. He poured another drink, looked at me, then grinned. He lifted the glass in a silent toast.
Yet I think it bothered him. The rest of them were crazy with gold fever, but I was not. And he didn't understand it. The Lost Village Diggings. Stories of lost mines crop up wherever one goes in the Southwest, but this one was even more fantastic than most. In 1609, three Franciscan friars, accompanied by an officer and 16 soldiers, started north out of Mexico. Attacked by Apaches, they turned back and finally were surrounded among rough mountains by the Indians. During the night, they attempted to escape and became lost. By daylight, they found themselves moving through utterly strange country, and their directions seemed all wrong. All of them felt curiously confused. Yet they had escaped the Indians. Thankfully, they kept on, getting deeper and deeper into unfamiliar country. On the third day, they found themselves in a long canyon through which wound a stream of fresh, clear water. There were wide green meadows, rich soil, and a scattering of trees. Weary of their flight, they gratefully settled down for a rest. And then they found gold. The result was, instead of going on, they built houses and a church and remained to mine the rich ore and reduce it to raw gold. Accompanied by one of the Indians who had come with them, for there had been a dozen of these, four soldiers attempted to find a way out to Mexico. All were killed but one, who returned. Attracted by the healing of one of the Franciscans, several Tarahumares came to live among them, and then more. Several of the soldiers took wives from the Indian girls and settled down. Lost to the outside world, the village grew, cultivated fields, and was fairly prosperous, and they continued to mine gold. Yet a second attempt to get out of the valley also failed, with three men killed. It was only after 30 years had passed that an Indian succeeded. He got through to Mexico and reported the village. Guiding the party on the return trip, he was bitten by a snake and died. In 1750, two wandering Spanish travelers stumbled upon a faint trail and followed it to the village. It had grown to a tight, neatly arranged settlement of more than 100 inhabitants. The travelers left, taking several villagers with them, but they likewise were killed by Apaches. Only one man got through, adding his story to the legend of the lost village. From that day on, it was never heard of again.
"All my life," old Tom Curtis said, "I've hoped I'd find the village. Millions, millions in gold there all stored and waiting to be took. A rich mine, maybe several of them."
The big man with the golden beard straightened up. "My name's Lark Feist," he said. "I found the lost village by accident. I was back in the Sierra Madres, and I wounded a boar. I chased after him, got lost, and just stumbled on her."
"Folks still there?" Curtis asked eagerly.
"Nobody," Feist said.
"Not a soul. Dead for years, looks like."
He leaned against the bar and added three fingers to his glass. "But I found the mine, two of them. I found their arrastra, too."
"But the gold?"
That was Bob Wright, owner of the livery stable.
"Did you find the gold?"
"Not yet," Feist admitted, "but she's got to be there." There was an excited buzz of talk, but I turned away and leaned against the bar. There was nothing I could say and nobody who would believe me. I knew men with the gold fever. I'd seen others have it. So I waited, knowing what was coming, and thinking about Larrick Feist. "Sure," Feist said. "I'm going back. Think I'm crazy? Apaches? Never seen a one. But what if I did? No Apache will keep me away from there. But I gotta get an outfit."
"I'll stake you," Wright said quickly. "I'll furnish the horses and mules."
Men crowded around, tendering supplies, equipment, guns, experience. Feist didn't accept. He just shook his head. "First thing I need," he said, "is some rest. I won't even think about it until morning." He straightened up and gathered his samples. Reluctantly, the others drew back. Feist looked over at me. "What's the matter, Marshal?" he taunted. "No gold fever?" "Once," I said, "I had it."
"He sure did," old Tom Curtis chuckled. "Why, he was only a boy, but he sure spent some time down there. Say, he'd be a good man to take along. The Marshal sure knows the Sierra Madre."
Feist had started to move away. Now he stopped. His face had a queer look. "You've been there?" he demanded. "Yes," I spoke quietly. "I've been there." That was the beginning of it. Lark Feist avoided me, but his plans went forward rapidly. A company was formed with Feist as president, Wright as treasurer, and Dave Neal as vice president. When I heard that, I walked down to Neal's house. Marla was out in the yard picking flowers. "Your dad home?" She straightened and nodded to me. It seemed she was absent-minded, not like she usually was when I came around. I stood there and I looked myself over in her eyes. I was a big man, 2 inches shorter than Feist and maybe 20 pounds less in weight,
Yet I'm mighty spare and muscular, and folks generally figure me to weigh no more than 200 and a few pounds.
So I knew what she saw, a big man with wide, thick shoulders and a chest that stretched his shirt tight, with a brown, wind-darkened face and green eyes, a shock of black, curly, and unusually untrimmed hair, a battered black sombrero flat-crowned, a faded checked shirt, jeans and boots with run-down heels, and two big guns that looked small on him. Feist was different. He had the trail dust off him now and a new outfit of clothes, bought on credit. He looked slick and handsome, his hair was trimmed. He was the talk of the town, with all the girls making big eyes at him. They all knew me. They all knew Lou Morgan, who was half Irish and half Spanish.
"Yes, Dad's inside talking to Larrick," she said. "Isn't he wonderful?"
That hurt. Marla? Well, I'd always figured on Marla being my girl. We'd gone dancing together, and we'd been riding together, and we'd talked some about the future when I'd made my stake and owned a ranch. "Wonderful?" I shook my head. "That doesn't seem like the right word."
"Oh, Lou," she was impatient. "Don't be like that. Here Larrick comes to town and offers us all a chance to be rich. And you stand around. They all told me how you acted, just like you were jealous of him."
"Why should I be jealous?" I asked. Her eyes chilled a little.
"Oh, you don't think I'm worth being jealous over."
That made me look at her again. "Oh, so you're in this too. It's not only all the town's money he wants, but you too."
"You've no right to talk that way. I like Larrick. He's wonderful, and he's doing something for us all."
Right then, I couldn't trust myself to talk. I just walked by her and went into the house. Neil was there, seated at the table with Feist, Wright, Curtis, and John Powers. They all had money on the table and some sort of legal-looking papers.
"What's the money for?" I asked quietly.
"We're buying into Mr. Feist's mine," Powers said. "You'd better dig down in that sock of yours and get a piece of this, Lou. We'll need a good man to protect that gold."
Powers turned to Feist and jerked ahead at me.
"Lou here is about the fastest thing with a gun this side of Dodge."
Feist looked up at me, his eyes suddenly cold and careful. Me, I didn't look at him. "Neil," I said, "do you mean to tell me you men are all paying good cash for something you've never seen? That you're buying a pig in a poke?"
"Never seen," Neil said. "What does that matter? We've seen the gold, haven't we? We all know the Lost Village story, and—"
"All you know," I said, "is an old legend that's been told around for years. You're all like a pack of kids taken in by a slick-talking stranger." "Feist," I looked across the table at him, "you're under arrest, obtaining money under false pretenses."
Neil lunged to his feet. His face was flushed with anger. "Lou, what's the matter? Have you gone crazy?"
All of them were on their feet protesting. Only Larrick Feist had not moved, but for the first time he looked worried. It was Marla who made it worse.
"Dad," she said, "pay no attention to him. Lou's jealous. He's made big tracks around here so long he can't stand for anybody to take the limelight."
That made me red around the gills because it was so untrue.
"You think what you like, but I'm taking Feist now."
Feist looked at me, a long, measuring look from those cold, careful eyes. He had it in his mind. "Don't go for that gun," I said quietly. "I want you tried in a court of law, not dead on this floor." Powers put a hand on Feist's arm. "Go along with him," he said, "and don't worry, we'll take care of you. Far as that goes, we can call a meeting and throw him out of office."
"I'm arresting Feist," I said patiently. "You do whatever you want."
"On what evidence?" Neil demanded.
"I'll present the evidence when it's needed," I said. "Take my word for it, I've evidence for a conviction. This man has never been to Lost Village. He didn't get his gold there, and there's no gold there anyway but a little placer stuff." Whether they heard me or not, I don't know. They were all around me, yelling at me, shaking their fingers in my face, and they were all mad. Neil was probably the maddest of all. Marla, when I looked at her, just turned her head away. Feist got up when I told him to and walked out ahead of me. "I might have expected this," he said, "but you won't get away with it." "Yes, I will, and when they discover what you tried to put over, I'll have trouble keeping you from getting lynched." When he was locked in a cell, I walked back to my desk and sat down.
Ever feel like the whole world was against you? Well, that's the way I felt then. My girl had turned her back on me, the town's leading citizens, the men I'd worked for, been friends with, and protected. They all hated me. And they could throw me out of office, that was true. All they needed was to get the council together.
It was 10 miles to the nearest telegraph, but when the stage went out that night, I had a letter on it. Up and down the street, men were gathered in knots, and when they looked at me, they glared and muttered. So I walked back to my office and sat down. Feist was stretched on his cot, and he never moved. Every night now for months, Marla Neal had brought me a pot of coffee at 8 o'clock. When 8 drew near, I began to feel both hungry and miserable. There'd be no Marla tonight, that was something I could bet. And then, there she was, a little cool, but with her coffee pot.
Marla, I sat up straight. Then you,
I got to my feet,
you're not mad at me?
Believe me, Marla, when you all know the truth, you won't be.
Listen, I can explain.
She drew back. Drink your coffee, she said, or it will get cold. I'll talk to you tomorrow. She turned and hurried away. So I sat down, ate a cookie, and then poured out the coffee. It was black and strong the way I like it. Very black and very strong. My mouth tasted funny when I awoke, and I had trouble getting my eyes open. When I got them open, I rolled and caught myself just in time. It wasn't my bed I was in, I was on a jail cot. My head felt like it weighed a ton, but I lifted it and looked around. I was in a cell. Larrick Feist's cell. That brought me to my feet with a lurch. I charged the door. Locked. Taking that door in my two hands, I shook it until the whole door rattled and banged. I shouted, but there was no sound from outside. I swore. Then I looked around. There was a note on the floor. I picked it up and read.
You wouldn't listen to us. I hated to do this, but you'd no right to keep the whole town from getting rich just because of your pig-headed jealousy.
It didn't need any signature, for by that time I was remembering that the last thing I had done was drink some coffee Marla had brought me. The door rattled and I yelled, but nobody answered. I went to the window and looked out. Nobody was stirring, but I knew all those who lived in town were not gone. They probably had orders to ignore me. Then I remembered something else. This jail was old and of adobe. I'd been trying for months to get the council to vote the money to make repairs. These bars... As I've said, I weigh 230 pounds and none of it anything but bone and muscle. I grabbed those bars and bowed my back, but they wouldn't stir. Yet I knew they were not well seated. Then I picked up the cot and smashed it, and taking one of the short iron pieces, I used it as a lever between the bars. That did the trick. In 5 minutes I was on the street, then back inside after my guns. This time I belted on two of them, grabbed my Winchester, and ran for the livery stable. Abel was there, but no Wright. I grabbed Abel.
Which way did they go? I yelled at him.
Lou, he protested, pulling back. You let go of me. I ain't done nothing, and you leave those folks alone. We all going to be rich.
I dropped him because I remembered something very suddenly. Larrick Feist had changed his clothes after he came to town. Had he taken the old ones with him after he got a complete outfit? I made a run for Power's store, but it was closed. I put one foot against the door jamb and took the knob in my hand. It came loose, splintering the jamb. The clothes were there, a worn dirty shirt, jeans, boots, and a coat. Right there I sat down and looked them over. Not that I didn't know where they were going now. The Sierra Madres were far south of the border, and nobody except a few Indians and Mexicans who lived there knew them better than I. What I wanted to know was where Feist had come from, because one thing I knew, he had not come up from Mexico. From our town, the country slopes gradually away to the border. It's a long valley running deep into Mexico, and from my usual seat at the jail door, I could look down that valley. Yesterday, before Feist appeared, I had been sitting there, and Larrick Feist had not come up that valley. Nothing bigger than a mouse or rattlesnake had been moving out there. Now, just before noon, Luke Fair drove his buckboard in from Tombstone, and he had seen nobody for 50 miles, he said. The fact remained, all things considered, the only way Feist could have come was by train. The railroad was just 10 miles away, and I had spotted soot on his ears, which he'd not washed off. The dust on his clothes was not desert dust, no more than he could have picked up coming from the railroad, and there were some cinders in the cuffs of his jeans. All his clothes were old except for the coat. It had a label from an El Paso store. Tracking that party into Mexico offered no problem, but I had another idea. Feist, if I was right, and I was betting my shirt on it, would get his hands on the money that had been put up, then he would light out and leave them stranded, and I had just a hunch where he would go. Luke Fair was in front of his shack when I walked up.
You played Hob, he said.
I spoke fast. Luke, get a horse and a couple of pack mules, take grub and plenty of water, then light out after that bunch. By the time you get to them, they'll be mighty glad to see you. Luke looked at me. The fact that he was here and not with them showed he had brains.
What do you mean?
I mean, I said, that about 50 miles south of the border you'll find that bunch. They'll probably be out of water in a foot. He took his pipe out of his mouth. I don't get you.
That Feist, I said, was a swindler. He never saw the Sierra Madres. I'd bet a coon he never. He rigged that story, and the gold never came from Lost Village because there's no gold there and never was.
How do you know that?
Luke, what was my ma's name?
Why, he looked sort of odd.
It was Ibanez.
Sure, and Luke, do you know what the name of that officer was who went with the Franciscan friar?
No.
It was Ibanez.
Luke, I've had a map to Lost Village ever since I was six. My father went there when he was a boy. I went there, too. There was a village, but folks left it when the springs went dry. There never was any mining close by. The mine they took the gold from was 10 miles from the village itself, and it's being worked right now by the Sonora Mining Company.
Well, I'll be blasted.
Luke just sat there looking at me.
Why didn't you tell them?
I started to, but they wouldn't listen. Most of it I didn't want to tell until the trial. I didn't want this gent to know what he was facing. I had no idea they'd go off the way they did.
If I was you, he said, I'd let them get back the best they can.
They might not get back, I told him, but he knew that as well as I did. He got up and began gathering his duffel.
What about you? He asked.
That made me grin. Luke, that gent will head for El Paso unless I'm clean off my rocker. He'll ditch them about the second day out, and he'll head through the hills toward El Paso. He'll take a straight route, and about noon of the second day, after he leaves them, he'll stop for water at a little pozo, a place called Coyote Spring. And Luke, when he gets there, I'll be sitting close by.
If you look on a good big map, and if you pick a place about midway between the Animas and the Alamo-Waco Mountains, and then measure off about 28 miles or so south of the border, you'll find Pozo de Coyote. The spring is in a plain, but the country is rough and broken, and the ground slopes off a little into a sort of hollow. The pozo is in the bottom. At noon on the second day, after I figured Lyric Feist would have left them, I was sitting back in the brush with my field glasses and a rifle. He was more than an hour late getting to the pozo, but I was taking it easy back in a tall clump of choya and mesquite when I heard his horse. It was hot, a still blazing noon in the desert, when he drew up at the waterhole. Lifting my Winchester, I put a bullet into the sand at his feet. He jerked around and jumped for his rifle, but as he lifted it, I smashed 2 shots at the stock and he dropped it as if it was hot. The stock was splintered. He stood stock still, his hands lifted. Getting to my feet, I walked down the hill. Once he made a motion as if to go for his gun, but I fired the rifle from the hip and grooved the leather of his holster. When I stepped into the open, we were 30 yards apart. His face was flushed with heat and fury, and he glared at me, the hatred a living thing in his eye.
You, is it? I might have guessed.
What kept you so long, Feist? I said. I've been waiting for you.
How'd you get here? How'd you know I'd be coming this way?
Simple, I smiled at him, taking my time. Then I let him have it, about the map I had, how the Lost Village was not lost, and how there was no mine at all there, and no gold, and never had been.
So you knew all the time? It made him furious to think that. Now what are you going to do?
Take you in. I wired Tucson about you. They're checking with other places. You'll be wanted someplace. My rifle tilted a little.
Drop your gun belts, I told him. Or, if you feel lucky, try to draw.
Gingerly, he moved his hands to his belt buckle, and unfastening it, he let the belt drop. Then, stepping carefully, he moved away. I closed in and picked up the belt, then shucked shells from the gun and stuck the belt and gun in my saddlebag. Then I spoke again to Lyric Feist. Now get ready to travel, fella. 3 days later, I rode into town, with Lyric Feist tied to a saddle. He had made one break to escape, and had taken a bad beating. His eyes were swollen shut, and his beard matted with blood and sand. He looked like he had been dragged through a lava bed on his face. There was nobody in sight. Soon a few people, mostly women, came to the doors to watch. Luke Fair strolled out, finally. I handed in the pouch containing the money I'd recovered.
"Where is everybody? Did you find him?"
Fair grinned at me.
"Found him just like you said, afoot and out of water. He'd stolen their horses and canteens, but I rounded up the horses that he'd turned loose, and we started back."
"But where are they?" He chuckled.
"They're mining," he said. "Working one of the richest ledges I ever saw. We started back, but about 10 miles below the border, Power sits down for a rest and crumbles a piece of rotten quartz, and it was fairly alive with gold. So they all staked claims, and they all figure that they're going to get rich."
He started to walk toward the bank, then stopped.
"Marla's in town," he said.
When I jailed Feist, I thought about it.
Suddenly I knew what I was doing. The law could have Feist, and they could have their marshal's job. Marla opened the door for me, and she'd never looked prettier. Some of it was last-minute fix, and I could easily see that. My badge was in my hand. "Give that to your dad," I said. "He and Powers wanted a new marshal. Now they can get him."
"But they were angry, Lou," she protested. "They weren't thinking."
"Be the same way next time. Feist is in jail. You can turn him over to the law, or hang him, or let him rot there, or turn him loose for all of me." Marla looked at me. She didn't know what to say. She was pretty, and she knew it. But suddenly, that meant nothing at all to me, and she saw it. And believe me, it was the only thing she had, the only weapon, and the only asset. I could see that then, which I could not see before.
"Where are you going?" she asked hesitantly.
My horse was standing there, and I stepped into the saddle. "Why," I said, "I've been settin' here since I was a kid talking to folks who'd been places. Once I made a trip to Tombstone, but this time I'm really travelin'. I'm going clear to Tucson." So I rode out of town, and I never looked back. Not once.
I have another one from Louis L'Amour for you here. This is called The Drift. Smoke Lamson came into the